When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
Today, I am feeling like an individual. And I think I'm the kind of person that ever since I was a young child, I've had very strong individual kind of streaks where I just couldn't really resist but be myself in a very loud, performative kind of way. But I've been thinking a lot this week about the individual in relation to society, but also the individual in terms of like your own community and how that we can't really function on our own unless we do have our friends and loved ones and also a kind of wider community of people that we might not know, but people that we identify with. And there's an artist who I have loved for many, many years now, who we have the great privilege of speaking to today, all the way from Los Angeles. And a number of years ago, my friend Emma Reeves took me to the opening. It was all very fancy and kind of like very glamorous because we were in Los Angeles at MoCA. And I went to Catherine, our guest's incredible show, 700 Nimes Road, which was based on the interior spaces and homes of Elizabeth Taylor. And it was a really incredible exhibition. And it was actually the first kind of major solo exhibition. And it was across, I think there were maybe three exhibitions in total on at the same time. And I got to see them while I was in LA. And it was just transformative, incredible experience I had. And then I went away and bought the book and sort of learned about Catherine's history, making the most incredible photographs of communities that you and me ourselves kind of are part of on a wider level in the LGBTQ.
Well, I mean, in some ways, it's a family you make for yourself, isn't it? You have your biological family. And as Armistead Maupin says, you have your logical family, which is the family that you bring close to you that allows you to really be who you are. And they support all your choices and all your persuasions and whatever you're into, and you feel safe that you can express yourself with this like-minded people around you.
Well, just that. I was about to say just that, babe, but I will say that. Just that, babe.
We babe.
Yeah, and the other day in Margate, we had a visit, well, just before lockdown happened, I think it was like February, we had a visit from a lovely couple from LA, Rodney and Tucker, and they run a gallery called Nona Cahill Gallery in Los Angeles. And I found out that Rodney has a son with Catherine, and I immediately said, we have to interview Catherine. It was like my first thing when I found out, because I was such a big fan. So I'm so glad this has finally happened. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art, Catherine Opie.
Thanks you guys for such a great introduction, and it's nice to be talking across the pond.
It's amazing to talk to you. And it's everybody we spoke to about you, Catherine, has said it's Kathy. Along the whole journey of knowing your work, it's Kathy Opie. It feels like you come across as a very, very shorthand, open, friendly person. No, I haven't had any bad energy. Everything's been so positive about you.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. But yeah, I am Kathy. But a lot of times people want to match that with the last name Opie, where they spell it C-A-T-H-I-E. I have always been Kathy with a Y, so I'm setting the record straight on that, because it's just that. Like, I know it looks good aesthetically with Opie to have the I-E, but nah, I'm Kathy with a Y.
We got it. It's official now. Everybody listening.
It's official.
It's Rob was just mentioning Rodney then, and the first thing that came to my mind from doing the research is I pictured a Russell Wright teacup and a turkey baster when he said that.
Oh, yeah, there is. It's true. It's true. That's exactly what happened. It's been talked about actually I've interviewed, and I was living in New York. I had moved from LA, And I was living in New York, teaching at Yale, and moved to the whole kind of New York City art community, which is very different than the LA art community. And the only kind of really great guy that I knew was the director of the gallery I showed at Jay Gorney. And Rodney had been his director for years, and he was a fellow Midwestern guy, and I had known him for 10 years, and I just kind of invited him out to dinner and then blew his mind by saying, "Hey, can I have your sperm? I want to have a baby."
Did he take a lot of persuading, or was he like, sure?
You know what? He took about 3 weeks to think about it. He took it very seriously, and he had a lot of questions, and it was a really, really big ask, as it would be from anybody, because I was asking for him to be acknowledged as a biological father, but then not having any fiscal kind of attachment or legal attachment to that child. So that's a really, really big ask. And I'll have to say that he said yes, which I'm really grateful for. And I did get pregnant in New York. And then I was headhunted back to L.A. by UCLA to teach from Yale. And they offered me tenure, and Yale didn't counteroffer. And so I moved back to L.A. with Rodney going like, "But you're pregnant with my child."
Wow. And you went straight into a teaching post.
I did. I moved back home 8 months pregnant back to L.A., and I couldn't take a leave of absence because it was my first quarter teaching. So I basically taught right up to the time that I went into the delivery room, and then I took a few weeks off, and then spring break happened, and then I went back to teaching in April. So Oliver was born in February, and I went back to full-time teaching as well. I had completed a show at the Walker of Ice Houses at that point in time in Skyways. So I worked all the way constantly through my pregnancy and up to the point that I had him.
Wow.
And then Rodney moved out when Oliver was 3 months old to Los Angeles. And my partner, Julie, who was finishing teaching at Wash U in St. Louis, moved out when he was 3 months, too. So then all of a sudden, I had this immediate family. It was like, whoa. Yeah. It was me and the baby, and now you guys are here.
Oh. Wow. Well, what's amazing about this story, Kathy, is the fact that one of your most iconic works is there's I'd say it's a triptych, but they were done over that there was like a decade in between the third one. But there were self-portraits that you made, and one of them was self-portrait cutting, and one of them self-portrait pervert. And the self-portrait cutting is you from behind, and there is you've had kind of with like pierced into your back, like a childlike drawing of two women holding hands with a house in the background and a tree. And at that point, it felt like you were longing for this family that you never felt this kind of queer dream was possible, to have this nuclear family. And then cut to now we're talking to you, and you've done all that. And I think that's such a wonderful journey, right?
Yeah, from the cutting to cut to, exactly. Yeah. No, it was always a dream. I mean, I went around as a kid, total tomboy, and saying like, I want to have 12 kids. And I always was a babysitter, and I was always a camp counselor. I was a camp counselor probably longer than anybody should be a camp counselor. I almost went into it full time, but art won out.
What is that? What's a camp counselor? We don't have that.
Yeah, I know a lot of you guys send your kids to America for the American overnight camp experience. Right. So basically your kids go to a camp where they get to swim, boat, do archery, you know, do arts and crafts. Mm-hmm. And you go away anywhere between all summer, 3 months to 1 week is the earliest you can go. The kids go and they're away and they have a cabin of kids their age, and they do outdoor things, and they hike, and they ride horses, and it's a whole thing. Nice. Camp.
Like a coming of age thing. And you were a counselor there, so you taught all these.
I started being a camp counselor at the age of 15, and I stayed a camp counselor until 21.
Wow.
So was that quite a kind of natural kind of calling for you to want to teach and educate and sort of be there on an emotional level for people?
Mm. Yeah, for kids especially. Yeah, for people. Yeah, I yeah. really, really love young people. And I'm amazed by all of their different experiences and what it means to become an individual and what it means to be part of community and how to be empathetic as a human being. But anyway, I do believe that part of learning about humanity and others and the difference of others is so much about a community approach to teaching people how to be more humanistic. And I would say that my artwork reflects that idea of differences and coming together in all these different ways as well. But that's like a really core part of me as a person is how do we get to be a better humanity? How do we get to actually care for others in a really positive way?
Well, that, you know, empathy runs through your work. Yeah. That feels like the vein of all of your practice.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, it's a really huge component. Like my motto in life is give more than you take.
Wow.
I like that. So when you were camp counselor at 15, going back to your childhood then, at 14, you already had a dark room. At 9, you'd been given a camera. So at 15, you were... I mean, I think I've read that you did your first selfie, your first self-portrait when you were 9.
Yeah,
so
when
during
I was
this
nine,
time,
yeah.
you were cultivating this, the photographer in you at like this age.
Well, yeah, and actually the camp was really great where they allowed me to take over a space in the big, huge... hall where you did like plays and musicals, and there was like this little cubby area, and they allowed me to build out a dark room to teach kids photography at camp as well. And then I became the official photographer for Camp Marston in California. I did all these amazing photographs that they ended up using in all their promotional material for years. So at 15, I was also And up to a few years ago, I've like looked online and I was like, oh my God, that's my picture from 1976 and they're still using it.
Oh my God. And these pictures you were taking at that age, do you ever show them or do you reference them yourself? Do you look back at them and think, do you still have them?
You know, I have all my negatives. I was also the high school drama photographer where I photographed all the plays.
Really?
And it was one of the ways that I could make friends is I... actually used my camera, and I probably still do use my camera to basically, create a larger community for myself. And I've always kind of done that since I was a kid. And so I would go and I'd go home and print in my darkroom all the photographs from that play that night. And then I'd bring them back and I'd give them away to all the actors on campus. And then over the time, they all became my friends and I had a social group. And so photography has always been a really interesting opening for me to explore how to actually grow a community and give back to a community.
Mm-hmm. Didn't you also gift your photographs to your crushes?
Yes, to Suri, who lives in England. Hi, Suri Flack, if you're listening to this, you were my first high school crush. This is true.
She's got photographs that you did of her back in the day that you gave to her as gifts. That's so
cool. Yeah. I was so madly in love with her. I actually went to Christian camp because I was so in love with her.
Really?
Why Christian camp? What, like to heal yourself, Christian camp? Or because she went
Not at all, because it was her calling, Christianity. And I grew up agnostic and I was one of the few people, I think, throughout the 60s who people would say, well, what's your religious affiliation? And I would be like, none.
Yeah.
But,
but
Suri was a Christian. And so there was also Christian camps that people went to learn more about God. And I followed her on a retreat because I was madly in love with her.
Oh,
that's
God,
the best
so
way
romantic.
To find God, isn't it? Through a crush. That's the most genuine route into a religion, definitely.
Exactly. If people only understood that in order to be closer to God, you become a homosexual, then it would be like just a different world, right?
It would be an amazing world. the best.
Transformative. Yeah. So talking about back then, your first camera, do you still have that first camera? And were you also quite into the tech side of it? Like the kind of geeky, like you were talking about having your own dark room, that kind of fills me with fear. But like, was that something that you were enjoying doing?
Yeah, I loved it. I loved the solitude of it. I actually had my grandfather's darkroom trays because he had a darkroom in his basement in Ohio where I grew up. And so I remember my grandpa taking me into the darkroom. And then when he stopped doing photography, I inherited all of his first darkroom equipment in a box that he had sent me to California, because at that point I was living in California. And there were these beautiful old enamel trays, and I ate through them immediately with a powerful fixer and stuff. But yeah, I've always been really interested in the technical aspect of the medium. And unfortunately, I would have to say that even though now most of it is digital, I still think about photography completely from an analog place. Like when I'm talking to my assistant about what I want done to a print, I use analog language to her to be able to do the digital. I didn't catch up digitally. I wasn't one of the photographers in the 90s that, after doing all of this extensive large format and really technical stuff, I wasn't able to have the time because of teaching and everything. And I didn't need to teach digital because there's other people that I could hire to do that. So there's a certain lag for me at this point on a technical level about photography, but there's not a lag in relationship to how an image operates in the world.
Yeah.
Like that's what I'm most interested in. I was never interested in manipulating my images. I was interested in bearing witness to the world, and I can still do that with the equipment that I shoot with now, as I use it just like film cameras.
Right. And you have one assistant, don't you? That's someone you've worked with for a while.
Yeah. Heather has been working with me for 8 years now, and she's a full-time assistant, and she runs the entire studio flawlessly. And if she were to ever go away, I don't know what I'd really do. It'd be a problem. I don't know where some things are anymore.
it must be quite a precious relationship, that as well, because I guess, you know, I imagine taking pictures is such a personal sort of process, you know, between you and the sitter. So you almost don't, do you shoot with many other people around, or is it always just you and
the
sitter?
No, it was always alone. In fact, to have an assistant come into a portrait session for me was hard to let that in, because for me, it's really about the communication between who I'm taking a portrait of and the camera. And often that is very silent. Like I'm the opposite of, say, a photographer like Ryan McGinley, who will blast music and have everybody dance around. I'm the person whose studio is silent, and I'm very quietly telling them how to pose or moving their hands. And it's like very fast, which is unusual for portrait photographers, but it's also a very silent, meditative exchange. I really view it as this shared moment that's a meditated moment between us.
And there is such a stillness in some of the photography as well, like that portrait, which is coming to mind the way you just described it there, actually, of Mary in 2012. Where she sat on this kind of red leather chair with her hand, you know, poised.
Her hand poised right by her necklace. Yeah.
Yes.
No, I like the portrait. I like the silence in images, because the silence allows you to linger a little bit more. And I think that my biggest question, actually, with the kind of presence of digital photography in Photoshop, is what does it mean to actually be able to still stare? What does it mean not to be fully manipulated as a viewer into an emotional response, but allow the kind of, the multitude of expressions that happen from a human being to another human being, you're allowed to just sit with it. What is it to just sit with something and not be forced into an emotion that you're, or a reaction? Because certainly some of my other images are reactionary. One would say that the self-portraits are utterly reactionary and performative. But I think I'm more interested in the quietness right now. And maybe that's because I'm approaching my 60th birthday. That I'm not the same kind of, I mean, I'm still radical, but I'm not the same kind of radical that I was, say, in my early 30s and late 20s during an AIDS epidemic. It's different the way that as you get older, you respond to the world in a different way.
So do you find them works that you made, like the self-portraits of the cutting and the pervert, do you find them hard now to look at or to, like, look back on?
Self-portrait cutting has never been hard for me. Self-portrait pervert, from the moment I made it, and I knew that it was an image that it was really important for me to make for myself. But at that point, I wasn't really well known in the art world. And the first place that image ever showed was the 1995 Whitney Biennial. So it never shown any other place except for the Whitney Museum of American Art. And that was the first. And it was big for me at that age to have that kind of visibility. And super important piece, but not one that I ever felt the need to live with. Self-portrait cutting on my back. In fact, I sold the last AP of Pervert to the Guggenheim because I wanted them to have all three, and they're the only museum that has all three self-portraits.
Wow.
And because I also didn't necessarily need to leave it to my family, you know? It's just like, this was me at this age and this time in my life. And it's not the whole sum of me as a person. And I think that's why I switched to making landscapes and switched my work up too, was it's like, okay, what is like this idea of identity politics that then you only get to exist within that prism? And there are so many more things to me than just that singular prism of identity politics. Even though it's utterly important.
Yeah. I actually, like the works, because for the past sort of 10 years or so, there's a series of works you've made, including the Yosemite kind of landscape.
Fort waterfalls stuff.
Yeah, waterfalls and also kind of green, you know, beautiful out of focus kind of still landscape moments, and also pictures of the sea, which I really resonate with me because I've been living for the last year and a half by the sea in England. And there's something about what you said about how that Photoshop generation and how maybe you can be manipulated by changing an image digitally. But what I've begun to realize is that nature can actually manipulate you in a way. Like it can make you feel different emotions so strongly, and it's all completely natural. So every day I do a walk on the seafront, and it literally is the same route I take every day, but it's never the same because it constantly changes.
It's never the same. Exactly.
Yeah, and I love that. And I feel that in your photos. Like there's a similar kind of energy with the sunsets that you've taken.
Yeah, and it's also about how to debunk the idea of cliche or iconic, right? It's like we all tell our beginning photo students, no, you can't make a sunset photograph or you can't make a sunrise photograph because it's a cliche. Yeah. But in my mind, the cliche should be played with. It should be poked at. It should be allowed, and it should be reimagined. Like that's what we do as artists to a certain extent, is we open up other ways to think about things. Like we're portals to a certain extent. And I really love that idea, even you know, the recognizing that it's never the same. And yet, but in photography, in that specific moment, it's always then the same because that's what's captured. And so I love the idea that everything changes around us. And that's what I've learned the most about kind of my love of photography, is its relationship to history building. And then when you build those histories through various bodies of work that you've spent your whole life dedicated to this one thing, that it reminds you of so many things in relationship to what it is in terms of humanity and bearing witness, and that you can calm somebody down through a landscape, and then you can actually bring in a whole other intellectual response through a different gesture that you do with your camera, is utterly fascinating to me.
Wow. But you're talking about capturing nature as well. I find that with the photographs you take of architecture, of like debunking the myth of the American dream, Americana, but there's no people about. And there's something about that which has a dystopian feel that it almost feels like for nature, it's business as usual. If the humans weren't here, the nature would just, it would decay. The only way, the only reason this is here is because there's human presence. And the nature in them ones, for me, feels really like ominous. Like nature is just around the corner, just going to take over again.
Yeah, and it will. I mean, we were able to actually give the earth a little bit of breathing room from this unfortunate COVID, but for Mother Nature, she didn't mind the break. You know, what did I read the other day in the paper? Like there's only in the Northwest, up in Vancouver area, there's only 72, whales living in terms of killer whales. And there were 13 born this year. And maybe that's because the shipping lanes have shut down. Same thing with our mountain lions here in California, which are on the edge of extinction, the mountain lion. And over 13 cubs were born this year. And maybe that's because there weren't as many hikers. Maybe that's because there wasn't as much like traffic hitting them on the freeway, which happens, you know.
Yeah.
So Mother Nature really doesn't mind the breathe. And I think that's one of the reasons why I started abstracting landscapes and not only talk about the relationship to abstraction and that, especially within photography through the late 90s and 2000s, that photographers were going to a language of abstraction in similar ways that painters did. But mine were abstracting national parks, like iconic landscape that everybody knows. But by simply racking the focus of the lens, do we create a pause? And what is a pause for us at this point? And I feel like we've been set on a huge human pause with COVID. And so we have to think about the other implications of what that pause is and what it means in all these different ramifications, from what it can do from mountain lions and killer whales being born to just having a little bit cleaner water for the moment. Maybe we need to really pay attention to that.
And what does it mean for your work? What does COVID, this current climate, and what does this feeling do to you as an artist?
Well, it has been very fascinating to have so much time with my family. And we were in the process of dropping Oliver off at college, and we were going to get in our Subaru and drop him off. And I have, since March, of not being able to make work, really. Nobody's coming to sit for portraits. I put an exhibition up at Regan Projects in February, and now the exhibition is at Lehman Maubin in New York. Without me going there and having an opening and doing the normal things artists do, but I'm happy that people get to see the work.
This is Rhetorical Landscapes, right?
That's exactly, Rhetorical Landscapes. And so then I started thinking, all this stuff is happening in this country. I mean, we are under mass protests. We are under all of these things that I normally would go bear witness to. And I did start going to the BLM protests, Black Lives Matter protests in Los Angeles. And I did start photographing these protests. And then I'm pretty much of an avid news person. Like, I'm somebody who likes the news. And I'm somebody who started getting really jealous over photojournalists. I was like, gosh, God, I'm so grateful for photojournalists right now. They're showing us a world at a time where we're not supposed to leave our houses. Like, this is fantastic. And so on the week before we were supposed to drive Oliver in the Subaru to Tulane University in New Orleans, Louisiana, I bought an RV. And my wife said, "You what?" And I was like, "Yeah, I'm buying an RV." I said, "We're going to take Oliver to school in an RV, and then I'm going to go."
What is an RV, Kathy, for us in the UK, for people that don't know?
It is a recreational vehicle that you can sleep, eat, and go to the bathroom in.
So we would call that a caravan here. That's what we call it.
Or a camper van, yeah.
Camper van.
Right, so we call it a recreational vehicle, and we shorten it to an RV.
Uh-huh.
And so I bought a 25-foot RV, and I said to Julie, like, this is going to be my studio. I'm going to go bear witness. And so we did the family trip to Tulane, and we dropped our son off at college, and he's there living in a dorm and doing classes in person. And he gets to have that experience after having his senior year shut down on him, where he didn't even have a graduation. Yeah, and and so then we went on, Julie and I went on, and she could have gone on a plane at any time. That was our deal, that she didn't have to do the journey with me, but we spent three and a half weeks where I mapped out all the Confederate monuments, not all of them, because there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, but I did kind of a traversing around the country of photographing monuments that exist, monuments that have been removed, memorials like the Peace and Justice Memorial in Montgomery, Alabama. Went to the Robert E. Lee in Richmond, Virginia. That has become an activist site. To then moving on to Charlottesville, where the white supremacists marched, and photographed that as a place and a landscape. And then went to Breonna Taylor's memorial. So I mapped out a whole journey through the South to just do a little bearing witness that has as much to do with the politic of landscape at this moment in time in American history, and just reflecting on that.
And these would be without, these wouldn't have people in, right? These would be as
no, some have people in them. I mean, it was great. Like, I got to Duke University, right, in North Carolina, and Duke University inside the chapel had a monument to a Confederate leader that has since been removed. And this is the beautiful thing about bearing witness. Like, you don't know what you're going to get, right? Like, you get to a place and you have a camera and you get enthralled. So just by chance, that moment that I get to Duke, to the chapel, where a security guard let me drive my RV right up to the roadway of the chapel to photograph, there was a young African-American woman who had just graduated with her daughter, with a professional photographer with strobes, on the porch with her daughter holding a sign, "You did it, Mom." So I had this whole amazing moment of achievement at a time of racial injustice within this country, as where that moment in time of me trying to photograph the spot where this Confederate monument once was became a whole different story. And that's, you don't get that unless you go out and you just explore and seek. And I've always appreciated those surprises about that, and how it reflects on what you make as an image maker.
Yeah, it's a good, I mean, obviously outside of COVID rules, but it's a great message to remember, I think, as an artist, is that, yes, you might be able to make things at your kitchen table or by being kind of intimate and private, but it's also good to go out there and experience the world. And
I think for a photographer who reflects on the world, it's really, COVID's been, was debilitating for me at first. And also, I have to be honest to the people who are listening, I also question what it means for me to be an almost 60-year-old white woman who has spent my life photographing, and why is my voice even still important? I mean, definitely those are those thoughts that go through my head. It's like, why should I be photographing Confederate monuments? Like, is this even my place to do this? Like, is my voice even valid right now in terms of what's happening in this country with systemic racism that has just increased under this leadership, or lack of leadership?
Yeah, I think everyone's feeling their place in everything. But to say, Kathy, what you do is that the power you have is to represent people that are overwhelmingly absent in mainstream media, and that you have done that throughout. People that need to be important, because A lot of the artists we speak to are like, if you put these people on a gallery wall and people cannot avoid the fact that they exist, you are giving, bearing witness to an existence that is marginalized, sometimes within the margins. And that has been the people that you've sourced out, and that is why your work has been so important, and why you're a trailblazer. And you saying, like, you know, you're wondering now what is your place, but what you've done is, you know, like in the way that, so going back to the person that inspired you was Lewis Heaney, who bared witness to these, immigrants who were then in child slave labor, basically child labor. Yeah, his photographs changed the law of child labor. And what you've done is you've bared witness to this existence of these people, and by representing them, things have changed. You've managed these people are now
voice.
Known.
Yeah, you give voice, and that's the thing.
You amplify.
You amplify and you give voice. So, you know, I think it's important for every artist to ask really difficult questions about what their work means at any given point in time. And I just think it's important to ask those questions, but I don't think it's ever going, those questions will ever shut me down completely as an artist of what my natural desire is to kind of make images of or think about what's important to look at, because it's just, quite frankly, part of my brain and the way that I process information is I have to process information through, you know, like really thinking about it on my own level and what it means to make images of it. And you know, it's a passion. It's another passion. So one should never shut down their passion. But I think it's important for artists to ask a lot of incredibly important, hard questions right now as well.
Yeah.
Definitely. Does it have any resonance with COVID, especially with the AIDS crisis, when a lot of people in our community historically just were completely ignored by the government and underrepresented? Does the current climate now, is it scary how similar it feels?
Well, it's similar in a weirdly different way, because in a certain way, the people that have always held the power in relationship to ideas of white power, let's say, in terms of an American history, are actually like kind of denying the scientists as well. But they did it in a very different way, because it was based on homophobia and not, and the other being invisible, where like the kind of supremacy and white nationalism that we're seeing in this country right now has always been kind of visible in relationship to who holds power, but the voice given to it in the singularity of that voice is just extremely frightening. I mean, we're very worried that we will have a civil war here. We really are. We really think that if a good number of people really feel that if Trump loses to Biden, that Trump isn't going to go peacefully.
No, he's even said that.
But we also really, really believe that the military the generals will not allow him to have a coup in any kind of way. There won't be a military coup, so to speak, as we've seen with democracy and other countries crash down, that it won't be supported by our own military. So it's going to be an interesting, what are we now, 60 days almost? 60 days from the election?
I know, it's getting closer and closer.
It's getting closer and closer.
It's amazing what you've done with your latest show. You were talking about this up, that you've made these animated collages. Yes, rhetorical landscapes. There's two parts of it where you've made these animated collages, which we can get to, but the one that I love is, again, going back to nature, but you photographed swamps, which have this, the rhetoric of the American government, which is drain the swamp, and you've then got these images of these really beautiful swamps, which are incredibly peaceful, and they're taken in areas like Florida, which is heavily Republican. So you have this, you've absolutely eschewed this rhetoric and made it beautiful, which I think is so clever. It's so genius.
Same with my queer friends in the 90s. They were all too pretty. They were all beautiful human beings. You know, it's just like people and places are, you know, to weaponize. The idea to weaponize a swamp and drain the swamp and, you know, further problematic with the fact that swamps actually are never going to be drained. They're going to disappear because they will all be underwater because of global warming. And so that's the other thing, is photography preserves things. Like I was saying earlier, they it's the history. So these beautiful, peaceful, quiet images of swamps that you can just float away in your mind are also completely vulnerable landscapes that will be consumed as the waters rise. And then the idea of having something like the language of the swamp and the image of this beautiful, pristine place, then with the cacophony of what enters us all the time, which is just massive, dialogue around politics and people, and to basically base these kind of animated collages that very much come from your side of the pond and my growing up with Monty Python.
Yeah. Oh, right, yeah.
Terry Gilliam.
Yeah, exactly, Terry Gilliam. And it was a really great way to use another thing also that will go away, is one day we won't have magazines to cut out. One day we won't have newspapers to cut out. So both of these things are kind of disappearing within a digital age. But at the same time...
You collect images from magazines and newspapers, don't you? Like political images, and then you satirize them in these animations.
Yeah. I do. I satirize them. They're very satirical. Thank you for using that word. No, I mean, besides rhetorical, they're satirical, very much so. I mean, at one point I make Trump into a drag queen, so.
Perfect. I think that's too much of an offer. I don't want him to be a drag queen. I don't want him to be, I love drag queens. I don't want him to be a drag queen.
I know. I don't want him to be either. I want him to just go away. But it's just like, okay, look, you're just too much. It's just too much.
Yeah.
But it was, I did one. I did it on immigration, one on the rising waters. They all deal with different headlines that have been happening. The last body of work was the modernist before rhetorical landscapes. And that dealt with the idea of burning down the most iconic modernist houses in L.A., which is a film I made in conversation with Chris Marker's La Jetée. And that's the other aspect of being an artist, is I think that we're always in conversation with history, besides trying to make a different history and create bodies of work that can hold up. There's a beauty to responding to other artists and having conversations with them. So that was my conversation with Chris Marker, because his fear was nuclear war. And my fear is the relationship to nostalgia that we hold, because under Trump, he would like America to go back to kind of the 50s, I think, And so what does that nostalgia really hold for us? And how do we disrupt it? And if modernism was supposed to be the utopic dream, and we haven't achieved utopia, then what does it mean for an artist who can't afford to live in LA, who lives in a single room, begin to burn down these iconic modernist houses that was supposed to provide affordable housing, and now they're just rarefied treasure boxes? So always lots of questions. And that was that is why rhetorical landscapes got made, was if I hadn't made the modernist, because the character throughout the film makes a huge collage out of LA Times articles of not only their own burning down of the modernist houses, but also other fires in California. So the news in that piece is both fake and real news before fake news became a thing.
We're now in the post-truth era, aren't we? Yeah.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah.
So crazy. So you were talking about other artists. Oh, go on, Rob, what you can say.
Sorry, for those who haven't seen the show in New York, it's coming to a close actually quite soon, isn't it? September, the end of September, I think. But there's one of these digital kind of video collages which has what seems like a pile of guns with
the
American flag.
Yeah, the guns
flag.
Falling, raining guns, yeah.
Yeah, and there was something so powerful about that image. It just, I couldn't stop looking at it, and just the kind of the way that there's no figures in it, so you don't see anyone holding the gun, you just see this kind of heavy metal of the actual physical object and the kind of weight of that, but also the patheticness of it all somehow. And I don't know, it really struck me, that piece. Can you speak
about it? So hard, the guns, the proliferation of guns, and living in a country that is, it could be, you know, a militia. Militias have developed now under this presidency that are supported by the president. And to have people come out and pick up trucks with guns, and, you know, it's not that far away from what it looks like in terms of the Taliban, you know, or other kind of movements within in a country where they disagree with the support of democracy. The guns, you know, in terms of just even watching under the Obama administration, with not being able to put gun laws in place after kindergartners get massively shot, is just still a place of utter shock and dismay for me. And I don't like guns. I don't own a gun. I have shot a gun because, you know, when I grew up in Ohio, and you go out pheasant hunting when you're a kid in the 60s, you know, that's what you do. You go out hunting with your dad. And but it's never been anything that I've felt very good about in terms of living in this country. I lived in West Adams, where I had 7 homicides on my street. Of gang homicides within a 12-year period of time. And that's like literally me watching somebody hold towels to somebody's head that has been blown out, you know, from a fellow gang member. God. And so the incredible amount of violence to live in a city like Los Angeles through my lifetime, as well as just America as a country in relationship to guns, is just thoroughly it makes you want to knock your head against a brick wall. It's just like, I don't get it. It's just like, it's pretty clear what we need to do here.
Yeah.
So it's tough. It's a tough one. So again, that guns falling into a pile, it's like, you know, the animator, Sam Gurry, was my animator, who was a recent grad student from CalArts, who did all the animations for me. I brought her into the studio for a 7-month period of time where we worked together on these. But she was able to get such a great feeling of weight to the guns as they hit the pile, and how they spun, and how the movement of them is incredible, because all the pieces, there is no sound, but you don't need the sound. You imagine it because of the way that it's animated. And it's really an incredibly moving piece, I think.
Mm. It is. Well, let's talk about some artists that are your big influences. You talked about someone earlier on, but Hans Holbein, the Renaissance painter, who's known for painting Henry VIII, and I've seen it so many times, his work at the National Portrait Gallery, and just stand in front of it for hours. He's been a huge influence on the style of your photography, in the way that you stand your subjects and what they're back, what's behind them.
Yeah, no, I think Holbein was really an interesting painter because of his realism to painting, which isn't complete realism. It's not photorealism, because there wasn't the invention of photography. So, but realism was a thing, and the way that he can convey texture and everything, and also the way that his subject gaze was, I felt like that it was to be gazed upon in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And even when the subject, like Henry VIII, is looking back at you, you end up really looking more at his outfit than his face staring back at you. You know, so I'm really interested in the way he used color, the way he was able to pop the subject. Like Sir Thomas More portrait is one of my all-time favorite portraits of his. Mm-hmm. And then it was so great because the National Portrait Gallery hung my portrait of Thelma and Duro in the Tudor wing.
No way. And
it was there. That was last year. It was up for there for about 6-7 months where all of a sudden one of my portraits hung with the Holbeins and the Tudors at the National Portrait Gallery.
And that Thelma just blew my mind.
Yeah, it was with Thelma and Duro, yeah.
Love that.
Yeah, they have that portrait. Yeah, that you could always call over and ask to see that portrait. But it was an incredible moment, like to be able to have that portrait of mine hang with those portraits was, I would say, one of the rare, and I didn't get to see it either. I never got to fly over to look at it because I was too busy and then COVID happened.
Yeah.
What was the background you used for that then? Because what it seems like you've taken from Holbein, it was black in the background. Because what it seems like you've taken from Holbein is the poppy colors, like you've popped you give your character, your portrait sitters a regal quality because they're against these bright poppy colors.
Yeah, but it was black and lit in that way that, you know, Duro's clothing. So that's what popped. Thelma was wearing a Duro cape and Duro himself in his outfit. And yeah, it's really, it's a portrait that I'm incredibly proud of. And they hung it up before Harry married Meghan. And I think it was their nod to the changing of the royal family. It was actually brilliant by Nick to do that.
Wow. And another series of work of yours, which I find incredibly arresting and successful, and again is an iconic suite, is Being and Having, which you made in 1991, which is it's a series of portraits, very close up, which also reminds me of the Orange is the New Black credits. I don't know if you've thought of that, but...
Well, no, they thought of my Being and Having series for sure, because Being and Having was also the credit series for the L Word. They used some of those portraits when the L Word first came out.
Oh, really?
In their beginning credit sequence. So I think definitely... I love that.
I recently saw a series at Masculinities at the Barbican, so I was able to stay.
Yeah, and they're up there. I know. Yeah. I know. And then touring. I came out for that opening, actually.
Oh, really?
It was really lovely. Right. It was one of my last traveling moments, actually. It was coming out for that opening. And it's really actually a pretty great show. Yeah, I really like that show quite a bit. Yeah,
it was brilliant. But what it is a series of eight portraits, isn't it?
14 total in there. Oh, wow. No, 13. 14. 13. 13. Yeah,
and
13,
they all
picture
members of your leather dyke community, which is seem to be the cornerstone for, like the honorary leather dyke.
Yeah, they were all really groovy people that were my friends in LA, and I gave them like money to go buy a mustache at the Hollywood wig shop if they didn't already own one. And then I just did them on that yellow background in my living room in Silver Lake because I didn't have a studio. So my living rooms were always my studios until I got a real studio. Mm-hmm. And it was great. And actually Mocha, had artists make masks, and I used my face bow for the mask, and it lines up perfectly. It's surprising. Like, it's like if I wear it, it's like my nose is my nose and I have the mustache and the mouth over own mouth. And so people have been buying that mask. So I've been getting massive images of people with half my face on as a mask from... And which is really cute. Really, I'll have Heather send you some images of people with it, but it turned out to be, I was just like, well, why can't I use my face as my mask? And I was like, I'll use Bo. And it turned out to work really well.
Yeah. So Bo is the character that you gave your
Bo. Yeah, Bo's been photographed. Go ahead.
Go, no, they all had, you gave them all names, which there's one there called Pigpen, another one called Steak. Are they in this series?
Yeah, those are all their nicknames in real life for the most part. Like, except for Joni. Joni was Oh So Bad. And I love that she gave her name, himself that name, Oh So Bad. It's really funny, right? And it's kind of like we were gangsters, right? Mm. Like we were like butch gangsters in a certain way. And it was before drag was really being talked about a whole lot. It certainly happened within our queer clubs. You know, the photographer Del Grace had definitely played with it. I mean, it was there within the community, but it wasn't something that had necessarily shifted over to the museum world yet. You know,
What was it
so
like
it was
being
a real club scene?
What was it like? And do you still consider yourself the Leather Dyke? What was that like to be part of that community in like around that time?
Well, what do they say? Once a leather dyke, always a leather dyke, maybe? Even if you're not a player anymore?
Once a player, always a player. That's funny.
I certainly have stories of being a player, but I'm definitely like, you know, I'm married a good Catholic girl.
Did you? And you met her at Catholic camp, did you? Or?
No, I didn't meet her. I stopped going to church camps to meet girls or woo girls. But yeah, I think, you know, I after Oliver was born, I think I went up to see my best friend, Idexa, who I did a lot of play with, and that she's been in my photographs as well over the years. As Pigpen and Idexa probably show up more than anybody else throughout the bodies of work through the years. And, you know, I did a scene and I like was in it and I kind of like enjoyed it. But at the same time, like I had this like cute little baby dyke riding a tricycle around with a gag in her mouth. And I was like, you know, kind of every once in a while when she rode past me, I lash her with a whip. And then I like have a 2-year-old at home and I was just like, what the fuck am I doing? And it got a little too close to home, taking care of a body of a child and actually being part of being a top or anything like that, or even being a masochist either, was really hard for me to switch that mindset from caring for this child, to tell you the truth. I just kind of couldn't do it in the same way that I did. And so maybe now he's at college, like I'll bring it back. I don't know.
What an amazing thing to have, like you were saying at the beginning about finding our logical family, that these you're able to find your own people that you have documented and you have like amplified their voices, but you were able to find these people where you felt comfortable enough to explore this side of the human psyche that a lot of people are scared to do or wary of.
No, and I think there's so many misconceptions. Like I've had people over the years say, well, why would you mutilate yourself in those self-portraits? And I'd be like, well, it's actually not mutilation. I said, I decided, you know, critically in a conceptual way to decide to do a cutting on my body that represented a certain specific thing that I wanted to look at. And you would have to realize that the AIDS epidemic at this point is in full like massive way where I have lost over half of my community of gay men in my life. And what is the substance of that? It's blood. And so if you think about it, but often like that's the question I get in the audience from people is they'll be like, well, why would you self-mutilate? And I'd be like, actually, I don't think of it as self-mutilation. It was a piece that I controlled completely. And I don't, you know, and I think it's a lot of misconceptions around the SM community because my experience has always been the most amazing, consensual, provocative conversation about body and pain and living in this society has come out of that community for me, you know, and I've learned so much from it and I'm so grateful for it. So, yeah, once a leather dyke, always a leather dyke.
Leather dyke.
We
have a photo, like we talked about the triptych earlier on about, you know, the cutting one and the pervert one that 10 years later, there's a self-portrait and it's nursing and it's you breastfeeding your son now, who's talking about who's going to college. And you can still see faintly the scarring of pervert across your chest. Is that still there? Or is that kind of faded away now?
No, it's still there. It's still there, and it's slightly raised because I'm keloid a little bit, so you can kind of run your hands over it and feel the traces of the scar. And and it was really funny because there was a moment in time, like being a mom, where like you wear a bathing suit and there's pervert on your chest, and you have all of your friends' kids in the pool and they're all 4 years old and they're like, "What's that on your chest?" And I'm like, "Oh, it's a white ink tattoo," because you don't tell 4 year olds it was a cutting. And then they're asking, "What does it say?" Because they can't read yet. And you're like, "Perfect. It says perfect."
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Like, what is
that? Does that feel weird, though, still having that there? Like, looking at yourself now, it's part of your history. Do you see it as
Like tattoos. They're just a journey. It's history in the body. Yeah. The body becomes part of your history, just like your wrinkles and your laugh lines and everything else. It's just a tracing of the history of your identity and who you are. I love that
so much. And I was thinking a lot about it recently, you know, in terms of plastic surgery. And you know, I'm turning 40 this year, and I keep seeing celebrities, you know, even younger than me, who are like doing things to their faces and stuff, and you're just like, what are you doing, people? Like, because I love the romance of kind of wrinkles and, you know, the idea that it's the history of your life.
So sexy.
And all of this kind
I love
of
a crow's feet.
And also, I'm really into... You love a crow's feet. That is a quote.
I do. I love a crow's feet.
Crow's
feet from laughing. There's nothing more beautiful than someone who's been laughing all their life and they've got the crow's feet by their eyes.
I really love the idea, Kathy, of your body as kind of a material almost in the work, and this very clear decision, you know, you are in control of the photograph and of your body, and you know, and it's not mutilation like you say, and I find that very inspiring, actually. It's a great
thing. I think it's interesting how many people misunderstand, and it's interesting that you brought up plastic surgery, because that's often what I'll say in the audience, is that some of you are really squirming around in your seat over these images, but you wouldn't think anything about it in relationship to plastic surgery, you know? And so because it becomes language, it's making you uncomfortable. So I think it's just so interesting the way that we, you know, again, deal with things as people and how we see things. It's like, wow, that's really upsetting for you. I had a response one time at the Whitney Museum of American Art, where somebody reminded me of this. I was having a conversation on stage with Adam, and this is probably about 4 or 5 years ago, and Adam, the director of the Whitney, and I think the image pervert came up, and one of the audience members had such a visceral reaction to it that they threw up. Whoa. And it was like, wow, like what?
That's great.
And then you have to ask yourself, what are their processes as a person? Like, how were they taught? What are they thinking? Yeah. What is their relationship to kind of the fact that many people have cuts on their body and that they have from an accident or a scar, and it's just a part of something that happened, but to control something in relationship to a language is, you know, you have control over it. It's a very different thing than, I'm the biggest baby in the world. When I stub my toe, I'll cry. But if I have control over it, no, I'm not going to cry.
Yeah.
Did you cry when it was happening?
No, but there was a moment where, like, I moaned a lot when pervert was happening. Pervert was harder than self-portrait cutting on my back, and I have a videotape of it actually being done. And I had really good concentration through it until my friend Raylan Galena, who's an amazing body piercer and, you know, did a lot of scarification and knew exactly the depth and how to do it, and that's why I asked her to do it. But there was a moment where she decided to pop a pimple on my chest, and we were playing around and we were laughing, you know. And I'm sitting in a chair, and, you know, I have needles in my arm, and because we did the needles first, and, you know, a lot is happening to my body. And she, you know, and then so I lose concentration and I start laughing. And then when she went back in to begin to finish the cutting, I was like, oh, shit. And I had to grab somebody's hand and squeeze it and get back to a place of like being able to breathe, because I got out of that level of concentration as we were laughing.
Well, meditation, so, sort of, I guess.
Yeah, it's a meditation. Yeah.
Do you see it as performance art? We interviewed an artist called Kembra Fala who sewed her vagina together as part of performance art. Do you know that work?
Yeah, I don't know her work, but obviously I performed with Ron Athey for years, so I know his work really well. But I haven't seen her work, but I'll have to look it up. What's her name again?
Kembra Fala, P-F-A-H-L-E-R. She's amazing.
She grew up in California, actually.
Yeah.
She's based in New York since the 80s.
Okay, I'll have to check her out.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Yeah, I haven't seen her work.
Do you see, when you did them, Max, as well, was that like performance art? You said you videoed it. Is that something you would show as...
Well, with the cutting on my back was a very small group of people with the two stick figure girls. It was my good friend, the painter, Judy Bamber, did the cutting. My friends, Mike and Sky, who were there to help her because she had never done a cutting. And I didn't want somebody in my community who knew how to do a cutting to do it, because I wanted it to be apprehensive as a cutting. I didn't want it to be perfect because family is never perfect. So I wanted that to be translated in the way that it was actually cut into my back. And then my good friend Connie Samaras was there to help operate the 4x5 camera by putting the dark slides in and take them out, because I couldn't operate the camera and also like have the cutting being done. And that was small, but when I did Pervert, it was done in a studio in San Francisco. And I would go up to San Francisco in the summers and set up a portrait studio. And that was done there, and I think I had about 12 people there and somebody videotaping it. So it did feel more performative than the other ones.
Right.
Wow.
Amazing. Have you always enjoyed the complications of sexual identity and the complications of gender that your work tracks? Have you enjoyed it? Has it been like cathartic making the work and then an enjoyable thing, or has it been something that's kind of troubled you that you found your way into navigating through?
I love that question, and I've never been asked that question before, and it just like triggers all these receptors off in my brain, because I think it's a conflicting relationship. It's a conflicting relationship within my own body. You know, I was like, you know, born in 1961 to a nuclear family that had its own like weird issues, and it's so interesting, because even though my mom was more like a tomboy and an athlete, and she didn't present femininity in the way we think of femininity, I think I was allowed to be a tomboy in a different way because she was a tomboy, even though she was, you know, married to my dad and doing a nuclear family thing. And I think that it was always really, really troubling to me that I couldn't be accepted to who I was becoming or who I was as a person, and that I had to stay hidden and I had to, you know, pretend that I liked boys or do this kind of performative thing around heterosexuality and what the norm was. Like, that's a whole performance on its own. And so to begin to be out and photograph my own community and to allow that to enter my work was a really, really hard decision for me, because I had dreams of being a teacher, and I got my master's degree specifically to be a teacher. And I thought that by making self-portrait cutting on my back and Pervert and all this various work, that was really motivated because of the incredible homophobia in relationship to the AIDS epidemic and becoming an activist. I thought that I was just screwing myself. And so it was always a really conflicting thing to make the work, but I knew that you just had to follow what you were meant to do, that you should always follow the visions that are in your mind as an artist. And if you don't, then, you know, you're talking yourself out of something that could be potentially really good for you. And it ended up being all very good for me in terms of my career. But I certainly think that it's taken different tolls in different ways, especially in terms of how people assume you might be as a person because of your work. And so there's all of those assumptions that happen, you know, with that as well. And I'm actually much more humorous and different than my work. And I think that people always are taken aback by that. They're like, oh my God, she has a sense of humor. So I think
always,
that, you know,
you've always felt ahead of your time. Your work has always felt very ahead of its time at every step, especially with covering identity and the other and gender and queer ID and fluidity and our community and how our identities are shaped by our architecture and how the communities are shaped. And, you know, I find you inspiring on that level. I just think it's incredible.
I've always found
thank
that
you. That's so kind of you.
The empathy is so strong in it. Like, I always feel like I'm there with you, you know, as both the photographer, but also you can sort of imagine yourself in the people you're photographing, even if
well, you want to be friends with them. You want to hang out with them. You want to go drinking with them. That's what I want to do with all your leather dyke mates. I want to go out on the night out.
And actually, even the show I saw at, Mocha that I mentioned in the intro, which was of Elizabeth Taylor's house and all of her closets and her clothes and all the kind of all the things that come with
ephemera.
A life of fame and wealth and being an icon, really. But it just became so, I don't know, there's such an empathy in those images. And
well, it's human. It humanizes her.
Yeah, totally. She's
She's no longer
a celebrity,
the celebrity,
but a real person. Yes.
A real person. And I think that we all forget that. And it's so interesting, celebrity culture. Like, what was it announced the other day that the Kardashians are not going to go on? And it's like people are super.
That was today.
People are super. Yeah, people are super upset about that. I'm just like, don't you think maybe it might be healthier for their children not to be in front of the camera all the time?
Yeah.
Like, don't you think that might be a little bit better for them? It's just what we put into celebrity culture and the notion of that being then that specificity of identity of that person, because that's how we identify them, is such a fallacy. And it's such a shame, because we all need to realize that there is, you know, like, I would even like to be empathetic to Trump at this point, like, just say, like, oh God, the poor guy, like, he must have been really fucked up as a kid to be this messed up as a person. You know, but it's hard. It's hard when somebody's doing such damage to find empathy, but I think we need to. I think we need to work on that all. I think that social media has been fantastic on some levels, but it's also allowed for this vitriol that is insidious, and it's highly problematic to all of us as in pushing humanity forward. We have to be careful.
This Elizabeth Taylor works that we were talking about. Then she was actually there for a lot of it in hiding from you while you were photographing her house. And then you're talking about you being ahead of its time. She actually died while you were doing the photography documentation, right?
Mm. Yeah. No, I've had that happen numerous times. I mean, I was photographing.
People are like,
freeways.
No, you're not going to photograph me. If you could, I'll end up pegging it. Don't get Kathy in.
No. Well, that was the joke when I was doing Lesbian Domestic, as I was kind of idealizing, after the cutting on my back, making Lesbian Domestic, I was idealizing these couples that had 12-year relationships. And I was like, why can't I have a 12-year relationship? And then I would photograph them, and then months later they would break up, and this happened three times in a row. So all my friends were like, don't let Kathy photograph you. It's like the death of your relationship. she was in the house. I never met her, but she was there. She peeked at me once from behind a curtain. I always anticipated that I would meet with her and show her what I made.
Yeah.
And then she would give me a thumbs up or push me out her front door. And, but you know, she personally gave her permission and looked at all my work to do this. And so that was, that was really amazing. I think I think, again, for her insight as also being a very complicated person to allow like somebody who's not a celebrity photographer, an Architectural Digest, to come in shows that she was also really trying to, you know, even in herself, show a human side, that it was different than what was portrayed throughout her life as a celebrity.
Was that something she asked you to concentrate on, some Christmas decorations at one point?
Yeah, she did. Yeah, she really liked the big silver ball, the oversized one. And that's one of the beginning images in the book as well and in the portfolio. Did you guys get to see it when it was up at the Tate?
No,
Rob saw it.
Rob saw it in Los Angeles.
No, yeah.
I saw it in LA, yeah.
Yeah. They hung the whole, it was up last year for months at the Tate. They bought the portfolio and hung it.
Amazing.
And again, I didn't get to see that. Both that and the National Portrait Gallery, I wasn't able to come over to London to see.
You know,
but yeah.
There's an image in that series which says her name, and it's almost like embroidered or something, perhaps on a dressing gown.
Yeah, it's actually on a chair for the movie set. And I tried to get Tim, her assistant, to tell me what movie it was. And it was either Giant or something else. And I forget if he said maybe it's Giant, but I don't know. And I forget if he ever told me what movie it was for. But it was great because it became like this title, like a movie title in a certain way, that this chair was sitting there with red leather and it was kind of folded. So it was like, you know, it had a movement to it. And it just reminded me of when the curtains move in the theater and they display the credits, you know, it just had that feeling. And I just was like, okay, this is really a good opening image.
For me, I love the impression as well. And it is because it's leather. Now that I know it's leather, I can see that in my mind. But like, to me, it was almost like you're saying, like velvet curtains, which has a kind of association anyway with theatrical and cinema and that myth, you know, around her. But it's also that idea of the kind of creases in it. It's almost becomes like wrinkles in skin or something. You know, it's got this, oh, it's such a great piece. And that was the piece that when I left the museum, that I remember being in the car park and we bumped into Helen Molesworth. And I remember I had that like imprinted in my brain, and it was like all I could think about. It's the strangest thing. And it wasn't even like one of the kind of figurative images in the sense of, you know, like the rooms or the jewelry or even the Andy Warhol or all of that, all of those things, but it was really stuck with me.
I like the pictures I love from it that are still like this great moment that happened is when her cat Fang walks across the Chanel shoes. It's like all the same Chanel shoes, but in different colors. And then all of a sudden the household cat gets up to walk through the image. And it's just like, oh my God, this is so, and again, it just makes it more human. It's like, this is not a shoe ad for Chanel. This is somebody's house who has all of the different colors of those shoes and a cat named Fang. So it just, it becomes a really different thing.
Yeah.
The cat was called Fame.
Fang. F-A-N-G.
Oh, Fang.
Oh, Fang.
Cool.
Yeah, Fang.
Wow. Cool. Amazing.
Yeah, I like that cat. I was like, can I have the cat? They were like, no, you can't have the cat.
It sounds like it's got an expensive taste with all them Chanel shoes. So we ask every guest that comes on some questions, and obviously we've asked
two
you those questions today, but two questions that we ask on every episode is, the first one is, if you could do an imaginary art heist and you could have any work of art in the world for yourself, could be a building, could be another photographer's work, could be a pair of Chanel shoes from Liz Patel's house, what would that be and why?
Oh boy. There's so many great pieces, but I will have to go with, there's two that I, can I have two or only one?
Yes, you can, because you're Kathy Opie. We will let you have
Okay. If I was only to have one, I would probably take Picasso's portrait of Gertrude Stein.
Yes. At the Met, isn't it? Is that the Met?
It's at the Met. And if I couldn't, and then if I got to steal a second piece, it would be Alice Neal's portrait of Warhol.
After he's been shot with the scars.
I love that.
Yes. That painting is just mind-blowing. It's
incredible
painting.
Yeah.
Incredible painting. So those are my two art heists that I would take with me to my desert island to live on.
Wow. I like the Gertrude Stein, because there's something about Gertrude Stein that she's quite... she's very butch in that, in the image that Picasso's done of her, which really relates to your work. I can see a lot of the character of Gertrude going through the portraits, a lot of your sitters.
Yeah, no, the body positioning in that, in the chair, is just like, and yeah, it's a phenomenal portrait. It really is.
Yeah. I always thought of the face as well in that work. It's almost like it's kind of masked. It's
pre-cubist, like kind of, isn't it? It's just before you.
Well, you know, he really does. Cubist. Yeah, the clothing has more form to it, and then the cubism comes up in the face of Gertrude Stein, and it was it is you're right. It's a very interesting gesture.
I think it kind of made me think of death masks and things like that. You know, do you know what I mean? Like those. Like casts or something. It's got a the other question we ask every guest is, what is your favorite color?
That's easy, blue.
And why blue? And
why?
Oh, blue just is the water and the sky. It's like, it's the place that you can float, and especially the blue of dusk. Like if I could just have like dusk wrap me up like I could be swaddled in dusk. That would make me very happy, because there's just something about that moment as after the sun goes down and you get that deep, deep blue, that there's no other blue like that. And it can't, I've tried to represent it within landscapes, and I've gotten close one time on this Lake Erie photograph where it's snowy. And you see the footprints of an animal. I'll have Heather send you a copy of it. And it's, I grew up on Lake Erie in Ohio. And so I did this whole body of work for the Cleveland Clinic of the lake at different seasons. But it's that wintry dusk that the snow turns blue, the sky is blue. And it just like, there's something about that blue.
Wow. Wow. One more question. Will you just tell us a little bit about what Club Fuck was like?
It was the best. It was the best until the rest of LA discovered us, and they decided to end up watching us like we were like a little freak show for their entertainment. But before that, when it was just ours and it was pure queer space, there was nothing like it. The performances that would happen, the music that would be laid
like what
down.
like what performances?
Oh, everybody performed there. I mean, you know, Divinity Fudge would do something, you know, Daryl, like Ron Athey performed, Crystal Cross, like we would do, there would be live stage performances of like basically, you know, club SM stuff. And so, you know, there was poetry read sometimes. It was just this really kind of amazing queer scene of visibility. And it was sweaty bodies and, you know, a lot of collars with locks on, with people being led by leashes, and a lot of latex and a lot of leather. And there was a pool table in the space as well for a moment in time. And it's funny, I didn't take a lot of pictures there. I have one night of bad snapshots. But it was really special. My friend Sweet Pea, you know, ran the front door, and James and Miguel started it, and they're both no longer with us. And, you know, Joseph Brooks also DJed there. And then after Fuck, they started the club on Santa Monica Boulevard, Cinematic, which was much more club-like in terms of dancing, where I felt like Club Fuck was more of a space of expression and dancing.
Wow. I wish I could have gone there. I would have led Rob around on a leash the whole night and hit him constantly. I would have done, loved it.
Wish.
Well, it's like Gail Rubin has a great story from the San Francisco leather days, right? She's one of the great historians of gay male leather bar life of San Francisco. And Gail once was at a club with Foucault, and Foucault had a little, you know, baby slave on the end of a leash and was leading him around. And Gail turned to the slave and said, so you know who's leading you around, don't you? And she's like, yeah, he's really cute, right? So, and then, you know, and then Foucault goes and figures out the history of sex, the history through going out to the desert and tripping his brains out. So thank goodness for that.
Wow. Well, this has been an amazing chat, Kathy. Thank you so much for giving us your time.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I really, really enjoyed it. And I'm glad it worked out. So,
yeah. What's next for you? Where can we see your work next? I think Masculinities is touring to Denmark. I might have got that wrong with the Barbican show. And then you have work coming up soon elsewhere. Do you have plans? I know it's like a weird time to be planning shows, but
no, I'm gonna edit what I have, and I'm gonna see if somehow rhetorical landscapes can be expanded upon with the other work that I've just made for a potential museum show somewhere. Like I love what I made for the exhibition Rhetorical Landscapes, but I also feel like the landscapes that I just went on to bear witness to could feed into swamps and the animated collages somehow. Yes. So if not, maybe there are separate rooms, you know, that you kind of enter, but I'm going to start playing around with that idea because I feel like the modernist rhetorical landscapes and what I'm making now all have a voice with one another. The collages are going to go to the Moody in Houston and be shown throughout up into the election. And then I did a piece called Political Marches that'll be shown on the outside of the University of Berkeley's outside screen. And every march that I photograph, I stand in the middle and I just photograph as the marchers pass me on. So I did a sequence from basically an anti-war march to a immigration march to the Women's March, to Black Lives Matter March. I sequenced those four different marches into a slideshow where people are moving past you on the screen.
Wow.
And so that'll be up at Berkeley. And so other than that, I'm going to take off in the RV again in October and go up and photograph Portland and up into Seattle to look at what that site of city of over 100 days of protests looks like and do a little bearing witness to that.
Yeah, sure.
So that's what I'm up to.
Great. Amazing. We love you, Kathy.
Kathy Opie, thank you so much for joining us. This has been, honestly, that was just transformative for me. I absolutely loved every minute of listening to you speaking. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for inviting me. And when I get over there, I hope we can all have a drink together.
We'd love that.
I want to get back to LA.
Yeah, of course.
Or when
you get back to LA, give me a call.
Big time. And for images of all artworks we've discussed in today's episode, you can visit our Instagram at TalkArt. Kathy, are you on Instagram? I can't remember.
I'm a really bad Instagram person. I'm trying to be better.
I feel like we sent you a direct message on there once. I think after I met Rodney, maybe.
Did I even respond? I doubt it.
No, I don't think you did. No. I think we ended up finding you another way.
I was furious. I was like, everyone's saying she's lovely. She's not. She's ignoring me.
I haven't figured out how to do it.
To be honest, it sounds like you're very busy with making your photos.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard for me to do it. I want to participate. And every once in a while I try to, but...
You're analog. Yes. You said you
think
you're analog.
You're
going to
be all over our Instagram very soon.
Yes.
So
loving.
But I'm CSOP on Instagram. So CSS and Sue OPIE. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's perfect. Where I'm on Instagram. But I'm not
wonderful.
Well, we'll be the judge of that, Kathy.
I'll try to be better.
Oh, amazing. Well, thank you so much. It's been brilliant.
Absolutely.
See you, everyone.
Thank you.
See you next time.
Very soon.
Cheers.
Thanks.
Bye. Okay.
Bye.
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 You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.